Welcome to the Engineering Influence podcast presented by the American Council of Engineering Companies and sponsored by the ACEC Life Health Trust. Today, we're talking about induced and reduced demand and transportation planning with Jeff Speck, president of the urban planning firm Speck & Associates in Brookline, Massachusetts. Through his writing, lectures, public service, and built work, Jeff has advocated internationally for city planning at the pedestrian scale. He is best known for his book, Walkable City, one of the most influential and widely read city planning texts in recent years. His TED Talks and YouTube videos have been viewed more than 5 million times. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Jerry, thanks for having me. You know, so, it's great. You're called the Engineering Influence Podcast. That's exactly what I try to do, is to influence engineering. So this is right exactly where I want to be.
Yeah, we went into the firm and asked around our employees what name we should name this, and someone came up with it and we jumped at it. So it's taken. As you would imagine, our membership is primarily engineers, and we do a lot of transportation engineering. But just to provide a foundation, the conversation, how do you define induced demand?
Well, induced demand, and again, let me set the stage here by saying I'm not an engineer. I did almost major in physics because I really enjoy that kind of thing, but ended up studying architecture. And I really approach this as a hobbyist and amateur who's hopefully objective, but who, I can't pretend because, I don't want to get, actually don't want to pull a Chuck Marone and get sued. I'm not speaking for the engineering community. I'm very often speaking to the engineering community. I think the people who self-select to listen to this podcast are probably the engineers who least need influencing, but I'm really grateful that folks are listening. And, what I try to do as a city planner is to be aware of everything. City planning is actually a really good career for people with short attention spans, because you have to know very little about absolutely everything. So you skim the surface and you see what information is out there. I have to say, though, that in my quarter century or so of doing this, I've found my focus more and more drawn to these engineering questions, because I think they're so fascinating and they're so often gotten wrong. And there's just this gap between what people who really study the information know and how the field is doing its work, that it's a message that we need to share as loudly as possible. So I say in my book, wherever I speak, wherever I go, it's a bit of an exaggeration, but it's almost true, that the one thing I make an effort to bring up and talk about every time I give a lecture, and that's every couple of weeks or so around the country and the world, is induced demand. Because I call it the great, black hole in traffic planning. It's something that most engineers, if you ask them if it's true, or if the data support it, to be true, and if they quote unquote believe in it, I guess we could say acknowledge it, they will say yes. But if you look at the way that traffic engineering and really traffic planning is practiced, at least in the US, it ignores the fact that induced demand is a known, very real thing. So to answer your question, I would define induced demand, well, I can't define it properly on short notice, but I would describe induced demand as the well-observed fact that when you add capacity to a roadway that is congested, in order to reduce that congestion, the studies show that that capacity fairly quickly, that new capacity is fairly quickly taken up by new vehicles. The data suggest that that on average, about 40% of the capacity about 40% of the capacity is almost immediately taken up by new trips. And then within about 4 years, and of course it varies, but within about 4 years, 100% of that capacity is taken up by new trips. Because the improvement, the change to the roadway does not happen in a vacuum. The concept that adding capacity to reduce congestion can work is conceived in a mental framework that ignores human behavior and how people's choices can influence outcomes. So and in fact, I like to point out that the traffic profession, I should say that the traffic planning and roadway design professions get two separate things wrong, which are both based on the same misunderstanding, which is that environment influences behavior, or the people don't understand that environment influences behavior. And that pertains both to congestion issues and to safety issues. So the fact that people change their behavior when presented with a freer flowing roadway is ignored in the traffic models that don't take induced demand into account, and most of them don't. Similarly, the way that people speed up when presented with streets that provide less friction isn't taken into account when people try to make streets safer in the conventional ways that are derived from highway engineering. So that's a quick answer to your question.
Yeah, it's
quick for me. It's quick for me, not quick. And there's a lot more I could say.
Oh no, I mean, as you were speaking, I was thinking of a lot of the stuff from your book, and also from, as you mentioned, Chuck Marone from his book as well, which both address these issues. In Washington, we had the 270. They widened 270, and traffic immediately flowed in again. They've widened 490. They've widened 95 south of DC, and the traffic has flowed in again. Are there sort of strong examples of places where induced demand has really sort of just kicked up in the teeth?
Yeah, I mean the poster child, which is funny because Houston right now is planning to widen, and so far we, and by we I use the term we lately, but I've been part of the team. We've been successful at slowing it down and stopping it, but Houston is now planning to widen its second widest highway. But Houston has the poster child for induced demand, which is the Katy Freeway. And the Katy Freeway was a $2.8 billion investment in what became, they call it the widest highway in the world. I think there's something wider in China. That may not be the exact number one highway.
I've seen the photo of the one.
Yeah.
It's scary. I think it's 17 lanes on each side.
Is that Katy or China?
That's China.
Yeah, well, the Katy is not far from that.
Okay.
In certain places. And they spent $2.8 billion to widen it specifically with the goal of reducing demand. They made it, specifically with the goal of reducing congestion. And they made that very clear. And within a few years of that investment, the AM peak travel times were taking 30% longer, and the PM peak travel times were taking 55% longer because people adjusted their behavior. And I think the key to understanding induced demand is to understand that in congested systems, the principal constraint to driving is congestion. Right, congestion is the way that we actually begin to pay the full cost of driving. Driving is what economists refer to as a free good, right? You don't pay anything near its real cost as a user. The similar planner's joke about parking, you know, another free good is, you know, of course there's never enough parking. If pizza were free, would there be enough pizza, right? And the same thing occurs with driving. The estimates are, through one study I saw, that for every dollar you spend on driving, society is spending about $9.50 to pay for your driving. And a lot of that, of course, it all comes down to us, right? We are society, but we're paying it in general ways through general taxation or other costs. Whereas transit is also subsidized, right? But the same study said it was subsidized about $1.50 for every dollar we spend. So we live in a society that you know, because corporate interests, I think, drive so many decisions that are made in this country for reasons we don't need to get into, we have subsidized in so many ways at the federal and state level driving that the smart thing to do if you have a car is to drive it all the time. And every mile costs less than the mile before. And the fixed costs are actually huge, and the variable costs are small. So one study found that if you drove a typical American sedan, like a, you know, like a Honda, well, American sold sedan, like a Honda Civic, I guess partly American made or largely American made, Honda Accord, that 4/5 of the cost of your using that car were essentially fixed for you. They were the cost of the car, the cost of the regular maintenance, the insurance and stuff like that. And only 1/5 of the costs were driving the car. Wow. So the smart thing, if you've made that investment in the vehicle, or even if you're, you know, paying off a loan, whatever, the smart thing to do is to use the car as much as possible. Society is supporting you in that choice measurably yes. to a high degree. And so how is it that, you know, what is it that's going to convince you not to drive? The only other path that we know of is one that makes the cost of driving similar to you as it is to society, and that's congestion pricing, or as we like to call it, decongestion pricing. And we could talk a long time about that tool, how successful it's been in the countries that it's been used in, how it's hopefully soon going to be implemented finally after like a 15-year struggle in New York City. But what congestion pricing does is it creates user fees that actually approximate, if you do it right, they actually approximate the value to you of the driving that you're doing. In the absence of that, the only limitation to the choice we make is congestion. So when you remove the congestion, of course, you're encouraging a tremendous amount of more driving until it becomes congested again. And it achieves an equilibrium. And I like to think of it as an equilibrium. You know, every road has an equilibrium, which is to be choked during in congested systems, is to be choked at the peak hours and free flowing the rest of the time.
Right, that's the way they're designed. Is what's your going a little off topic here, but what's your thought on I don't know what you'd call it, congestion pricing on highways? We have that in DC, around DC, where we have lanes that you can use if you want to pay for them, whereas lanes you can use when you don't want to pay for them.
Yeah, that's not congestion based. We call those Lexus lanes, right?
Right, that's how I feel, yeah.
And I've seen them south of DC. What I don't like about those is that they've basically become a tool that enables states and transportation departments to build more highways. So it's a very convenient excuse. We can't afford that new highway, and it's the wrong place to invest money as a society. Well, oh, but the users are going to pay for it. That's a pretty compelling argument. I think the problem with any sort of additional roadway and certainly those lanes is that, you know, you are inducing, with more supply, you are inducing more driving, and driving is the biggest contributor to climate change. To go a little bit off topic myself, my colleagues and I have been extremely frustrated to hear all of the discussions about how we're going to get ourselves out of climate change, and that, you know, all anyone wants to talk about is electrification, and particularly electric cars. Easily half of the pollutants that come from a vehicle come not from the burning of gasoline. You know, they come from the manufacture of the car. They come from the manufacture of the battery, which doubles the pollutants of the creation of a car. They come an amazing amount of toxins come from tire dust, mm-hmm. actually, that comes off every kind of car. And nobody's talking about the other choices we can make. You know, there's that funny meme that you see on Twitter where there's two people sitting at a dais, and, you know, and one of them has one microphone in front of them is being ignored, and the other person has like 16 microphones in front of them. And the person with 16 microphones is electric cars, and the other person right. is city design, walking, biking, you know, settlement patterns, all the things that add up to us having a lighter footprint, particularly, you know, specifically what we planners call location efficiency, right? And making choices about how we settle that determine how we move around. But the it's very frustrating to see the current federal infrastructure package, and frankly mirrored in many states and cities, who all say the same thing, which is we need to attack climate change head on. And oh, by the way, we are building more highways, which is the single worst thing you can do.
But you make the point frequently in your book that there are certain cities in the US that lend themselves to less driving. But most of the country is this spread out suburban, exurban world. How do we get rid of driving in places such as those?
We don't. I think most of my advocacy is to individuals and to individual municipalities, because I think what we've found, and we've certainly experienced recently at the state and federal level, is that we often know what the right thing is to do, but we don't do it. You know, we're not to get too political, but I think certainly at the federal level and in many cases at the state level, the decision-making process now around governance and policy is not driven by what the people need or what the people want. So I always focus on individual cities where a strong mayor or a good council or both can really have a tremendous impact. And of course, on individuals making choices. With the individuals I speak to, you know, I've tried to spread the word with my books, and I think Walkable City has been, based on the emails I get, I think Walkable City has been effective in a very limited way, telling people they can move. And I literally get, you know, it's not that often, but I probably get an email once a month from someone who says, screw you, thanks to you, I hate where I live now. You know, you've opened my eyes. I'm miserable now because you've made me realize that I could be living such a better life somewhere else. And actually, if you're willing to make certain sacrifices in exchange for much greater benefits, individuals making the choice to live in those parts of their metropolis where they aren't utterly dependent on the automobile, I think is an important trend. Unfortunately, it was temporarily reversed by COVID and this false perception people had that by fleeing the city, they'd be safer. In fact, you know, the places in the world that ended up being safest for COVID were some of the densest places like Hong Kong and Singapore and other places with other factors were at work. But first of all, individuals can make the choice about where to live. Secondly, I think in these places where folks are car dependent, you know, I might have harbored hope 20 years ago, 15 years ago, that we could stop sprawl. I wrote a book with my mentors, Andres Duany and Elizabeth Plater-Zybrick. We wrote a book called Suburban Nation. You've probably heard of
the book, yes.
That began with the premise and the hope that we could stop people from building sprawl. And, I've pretty much given up on that. I know enough about the mechanisms at work and all the incentives, and we can do everything possible to slow the spread of sprawl, but that's no longer my mission. My mission is to make more affordable and attainable, to make more affordable and attainable those places in every metropolis where more people really do want to live if they can, that aren't sprawling. And B, to take these places that you discuss where people really have no choice, and just to stop the bloodshed, right? Because we have tremendous carnage of automobile injuries and death happening in these places. It's about 40,000 Americans a year. Remarkably, and this is discussed in the wonderful new book by Angie Schmidt called Right of Way. Remarkably, we have a 50% increase in pedestrian fatalities over the last 10 years. It's gone up 5% per year, every year for a decade. And by the way, they investigated cell phone use and all the other things, but it's really SUVs. SUVs are the problem. Mm-hmm. When you're hit by an SUV, of course it weighs more, it stops slower. But principally, you're thrown under it, not over it. And that's been a huge factor, just not anecdotally, but incidentally. But in these suburban areas, there's lots of things we can do independent of, you know, transportation demand management and trying to find ways to help people drive less in this landscape in which transit is incredibly inefficient and money losing. But the best thing you can do is simply improve the dimensions of streets, you know, tighten up corners, improve signalization, put in LPIs, lead pedestrian intervals, so that people can claim the crosswalk before the cars start turning, remove rights on red. And then, of course, where the space is available, adding truly separated bicycle facilities which allow bicycling to be useful in a way that really allows you to make the choice to have one fewer car can be profoundly impactful. I think, you know, a point I wanted to touch on in this interview that we discussed prior, I think though that there's a fundamental misunderstanding around safety underlying the practice of roadway design in the US. It derives from the fact that roadway design and street design as a profession grew out of highway design, right? The first streets in America, and for a century or more, the streets in America were designed not by engineers. They were just rights of way that got laid out in conventional ways inherited from our ancestors. But eventually this profession of highway engineering became the profession, you know, it was the only profession associated with the design of streets, and it started as highway engineering. And highway engineering is fascinating and very logical because it teaches you that environment on a highway doesn't really influence behavior, because highways are so over-designed. There's, you know, so few impediments that the way that people set their speed is based on the speed limit. So when you get on a highway, if you're like me, you look for the speed limit sign and then you set your cruise control for 9 miles an hour, you know, over the speed limit. And so in that context, if you're designing highways, what do you do to make them safer? Well, you continue to remove any impediments. So anything that's friction makes the highway more dangerous. Narrower lanes makes the highway more dangerous. Trees along the side of the road makes the highway more dangerous. Intersections, as Chuck Marone talks about with his Strodes, make the highway more dangerous. Opposing traffic makes the highway more dangerous. Tight turns, right? And other sorts of woggles or wiggles make the highway more dangerous. So this knowledge of how to make streets safer became the foundation for all street design.
Right.
And in some states like Virginia, where the states own all the streets, in particular, and trees were called FHOs, fixed hazardous objects, even in city centers, it was especially profound. But this engineering, this branch of engineering brought into our city centers or even into our neighborhood streets are the reason why, you know, literally in Albuquerque, where I did a walkability study, one of 15 that I've done, you can't build a residential street that's for a little cul-de-sac that's narrower than 26 feet wide with no parking, right? And you can easily go 70 on that thing. So this idea that the way to make, and the way we set speed limits with the 85th percentile rule, we intentionally set speed limits, we intentionally engineer streets to handle speeds well above the speed limit, which of course induces speeding. And the great kind of intellectual shift we have to make is to understand that in urban environments, and by urban, I mean just where people are, in settled environments, we set our speed not by the speed limit, but by all those cues that we get from the spaces around us. And anything you do to reduce friction is going to cause speeding. And then there's this remarkable, you know, algorithmic relationship where a car going 35 miles an hour is 7 times as likely to kill you as a car going 25 miles an hour. So this difference between 25 and 35, and really 20, between 20 and 30 also, which is the range of speeds with which people are driving around people, is extraordinarily impactful. And it's exactly the sort of thing that roadway engineering determines, right? So they realized that half a century ago in the Netherlands and in Sweden and in other places like that, they literally had, you know, dozens, I think it passed 100 in 1 year, of children dying in their country from roadway accidents. And they rose up against it and they said, we're going to change this. And they revamped their whole transportation infrastructure around the specific goal of killing fewer children. And they went from killing more than, you know, more than 100 children in a single year to killing no children in a single year. The one piece of data I have fairly recently is, you know, Phoenix and Stockholm are the same size. And in Phoenix in 2013, 167 people died in car crashes. In Stockholm, it was six people. I'm gonna just rant for one more minute.
Okay.
This is a crime. You know, this is a profession, the American street design profession, whatever you want to call yourselves, that is legalized vehicular manslaughter at the engineering moment. And when a crash happens, first people look to blame the victim. Then eventually they might blame the driver. Yeah, you know, the victim wasn't wearing bright clothing, or they were crossing not at a crosswalk when in fact the closest crosswalk was a football field away, right? Then they blame the driver. Okay, that's often the right thing to do. But no one ever says, what are the engineering standards? And honestly, I don't see, you know, we've tried so hard to get those standards to change, and we've had so little success, at least at the national level, getting those standards to change, that I worry very much for your profession that people are going to start finding ways to make you pay for all the death, carnage, and destruction that come from these standards that are utterly bloodthirsty. So there, I've said it. I do really see, and I'm seeing it happening, engineers rising up within the profession to say, we need to change this. You know, engineers like Chuck Marone, who, you know, are threatened with disbarment, but for other reasons. But maybe ultimately for this reason, that people are saying the emperor has no clothes. And the idea that engineers are not culpable for building roads according to standards that we have identified as unnecessarily deadly is perhaps going to change.
Isn't that a catch-22 for the engineers, though? They need to follow the standards in order to build a road.
Yes, so that's why we'd like to see more action from the engineering establishment at its highest levels to try to change these standards. What I've been seeing is a lot of, and probably folks like the ones who are listening to this podcast, at least the ones who deal with road design, the more free thinking and perhaps, just to say open-minded engineers within the profession who are pushing for change have been the minority voice in the profession. And, I come from a profession, I didn't start in this profession, I joined it when I was about 30. I come from a profession, city planning, where we are very forthright, most of us, in saying that our leadership, our direction, our beliefs, everything we did from 1940 to 1980 was completely wrong.
That's an admission.
Like, we were pure evil, and we didn't really know it. But honestly, all we did from 1940 to 1980 was promote the wrong standards, promote racism, enable, you know, incredible racist outcomes. But beyond that issue, impose the wrong model, and as much as possible, destroy the proper model of city design in our communities. As a profession, we admit it. And what I'm saying is that, you know, your audience would do their profession a real service by saying, whoa, 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 stop the train. You know, engineering is such an amazing profession that's produced all, you know, I was just in the Museum of Art et Métier, which is basically the science museum, the engineer, it's really an engineering museum in Paris. It's the French engineering museum. It's just mind-boggling. You know, everything great has been invented by engineers, but the almost everything, but and it's such a respected profession. In fact, one that's operating from a position of much greater strength in public perception, I would argue, than the planning perception is or was, right, when it made its decision. And maybe that's a factor in why it's been so slow to change. But, you know, if the leadership in the engineering profession were to say, you know, stop the train, we want to say we were wrong. We want to say that actually, you know, a million Americans are dead who would not be dead if we design roads differently. And no, you can't sue us for it now, but we're going to change and because you might sue us for it later. And that's not why, but that's something to acknowledge. Right. I would love to see that. And you can tell me that you're stuck in a catch 22, but I'll believe that when I see the leadership of the engineering profession admitting its failures and doing something different.
That's a fair point. Yes. just to sort of close up here, it's been about 10 years since your book, Walkable City, was published. You had a lot, basically, I guess, 9 key points that you thought needed to be made to improve the walkability of cities, to improve livability in cities. What progress or regress have you seen over the past 9 years to that end?
I thought you were going to ask what progress I've made and how my thinking is advanced. well, first of all, I would encourage your audience to check out, as you noted, my more expensive, but less expensive than your typical engineering book, more recent book called Walkable City Rules, which, unlike Walkable City, which was designed for a more general audience and was designed to convince a lot of people to care about this stuff and to be active in their community, Walkable City Rules is full of how-to. It's 101 steps to making better places, and it's got a ton of data, photos, illustrations, charts, and other things for those people who are doing the work. So if any of your audience is actually, either as professionals or as activists, is busy in communities on this sort of stuff, anything related to street design, community design, city planning, I created this book to be a tool for those folks. So I hope they'll check it out. And I'm about to release in less than a year, 1 year, a 10th anniversary edition of Walkable City, where I am trying to answer the question I thought you were asking with a massive, maybe 40 page new introduction that I'm writing about what's changed in the last decade and what I've learned from that. I think, you know, COVID was a setback in some ways and a real benefit in others. The setback was the kind of confused urban, ex-urban migration that we've seen happening, and the impact that's had on some cities, which in many cities, actually the bigger cities, was probably a little bit of a good kind of release of too much pent up energy around moving into the city. And now maybe their economies are becoming a little more calm. But the main benefit, I know you didn't ask specifically about COVID, but that's what's having the impact right now. Mm-hmm. The main benefit that we've seen from COVID in many of our communities is this reclaiming of street space, both with open streets, which are streets that are effectively closed to automobiles at certain times of the day or all the time, with the removal of driving lanes and replacing them with parking lanes, and more often with parking lanes and replacing them with on-street dining and bike lanes and other things. Some cities have done it more than others. I think, though, that, you know, one thing that rose up principally, it started before, but rising up before as Walkable City was being published, was this idea of tactical urbanism, led by my friend Mike Lydon and other people, that the best way to figure out whether to make a change in a city is to make it temporarily and see how it goes. Right. And COVID was tactical urbanism on steroids, right? A lot of states relaxed their rules, allowing a lot of municipalities, or independent of the state, a lot of municipalities to make a ton of changes to their streets. Just to give one example, perhaps not COVID related, but tactical urbanism. I was in Chicago a week ago, and many of their intersections, they've simply created a flagged out bulb out zone at the corner. So you've got this typical urban corner, the curb is swooping around, cars are going fast around the corners because they can. And the traffic engineers in Chicago have basically laid out a tighter curb radius, which extends that corner of the curb into the intersection, kind of embracing the two crosswalks that it touches, put those little flexible plastic flagpoles on them. And the result is, I know they've done a ton of these in Jersey City too, like 100 intersections or more in Jersey City, that the streets there are much safer for pedestrians. So you see a lot of tactical things like that happening. I think that, you know, when I wrote Walkable City, walkability was actually a term that some people said, what is that? What does that mean? I mean, it's kind of self-explanatory, but actually the term walkability was new. And now I think it's something that everyone understands. And, you know, I've kind of lost control of the walkable city. Like I thought I owned it for a while, but it's just, now it's just so much what everyone wants. It's become just a popular term. I don't think anyone ever felt any different, but I think we've reached the point now where it's in the popular discourse that this is clearly a goal that so many governments and individuals within cities are pursuing. And I think that, as always, the challenge that remains is the distance between our ideals and our daily actions. And, you know, I see it as my job to get people to act on what they're saying, which is that we want more walkable, safer cities. And also, frankly, that we really do want to address climate change, because if you truly care about climate change and you're doing anything in your city that even maintains the current level of driver throughput on your streets, then you are not serious about achieving that goal.
Yeah, I one of the things that I reread Walkable City this past week in anticipation to this interview, and one of the things that struck me from the book was how many things we do that regular citizens don't recognize, actually how many rules and regulations and codes are out there that actually stop a city from becoming walkable.
Yeah.
Inadvertently, but that's what they do. And
yeah, it's just, you know, we grew up on the wrong model. After growing up on the right model, we made the change and we grew up around the wrong model. And these things are all reversible. I show people pictures, thanks to my friend Brent Totterin, who shares these on Twitter. He's got more than 100,000 Twitter followers. So I shouldn't give him any more press, but it's Brent Totterin spelled Tadarian. He shows these pictures of Amsterdam in the 1970s. And it looked as bad as Times Square in the 1970s. I mean, it was just, you know, they had a nation, and to a certain degree, Copenhagen as well, Finland. These countries were overrun by cars because they did what everyone did, which is to kind of embrace this exciting new technology. But they made a decision to reverse that. And it does take time. You know, it takes decades, but a decade isn't that long in planner time at all. And we're seeing a lot of cities make profound changes that are having immediate impacts in people's quality of life and actually in the success of the cities.
Well, great. I guess we can close it there. I really appreciate you taking the time. It's been great.
Well, I'm very excited to reach your audience, and I will be sharing this podcast myself. But I think the folks that you have access to, it's more important that they hear it than the folks who are already pro walking and pro biking. And let me just reiterate, I love engineers. Some of my best friends are engineers. And almost everything I've said about engineering today, I learned from engineers. So my beef isn't with the individuals. And also, I want to acknowledge that there are those within the profession who are trying to change it. But I do feel that we're lacking the powerful voice at the leadership end to really make the change happen.
I guess we'll see if that can happen. Well, thanks again. And you've been listening to the Engineering Influence Podcast presented by ACEC and sponsored by the ACEC Life Health Trust. Thanks for listening.